Hello and welcome to the Behind the Headlines podcast. I'm Hannah Storm.
And I'm John Crowley.
This is our 13th episode of this podcast. In each conversation, we've spoken with colleagues from around the world, people who have shared their stories, the stories they've covered, the stories that have impacted them, and told us about how they manage their mental health. It's so important that we have these conversations, and hearing from our guests really helps us try to tackle some of the taboos around mental health in journalism.
Absolutely, Hannah. Who would have thought in February that we would reach a baker's dozen of podcast episodes? We've got a really special one today, haven't we?
We have indeed. Our guest today is someone who's spoken about the impact of his work on his mental health, and he explores that in greater depth in his new book, The Madness. Fergal Keane has covered conflict and brutality across the world for more than 30 years. His work has taken him to some of the most dangerous places on the globe: Rwanda, Sudan, South Africa, Somalia, Iraq, Afghanistan and Ukraine. Fergal, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're going to be talking quite a bit about your latest book throughout this episode, but first of all, take us back to the start and tell us, how did you begin your career in journalism?
Wow, I became a journalist because I think there were a couple of factors. I wanted to be noticed, so I was a notice box. I wanted to be heard because I'd grown up in a home which was shaped very much by my father's alcoholism, and where it was difficult for a small child to be heard. You stayed out of the way, you learned strategies to avoid the dysfunction that was around you. But through all that time, I kind of nurtured an idea of myself where I would escape, I would do heroic things. And it seemed to me that those heroic things would be done in distant places, far away from Ireland, where I was growing up, in that grey, very Catholic, claustrophobic country of the 1960s. And I think, you know, during my teenage years, I was encouraged by a remarkable headmaster. His name was Jerome Kelly, and he'd been a missionary in the West Indies and had come back after the end of the colonial era. And he was full of liberating ideas, I suppose you'd call them, about education, about society, about achieving a more fair and just world. And he transmitted those ideas to myself and my classmates. And one of the things he was very big on was communication, television, radio. And he set up, which in you know, the Ireland as it then was of the early 1970s, to build a TV and a radio studio in a school and train us in how to do it. And then get us into the whole art of debating with each other and asking difficult questions. I was hugely lucky. You know, I can look back at things in my childhood and think, God, that was a rough deal you had. And it was at times very, very rough. But equally, I've been blessed in the kind of people that I've met at various stages of my life who've looked at me, seen some potential where I saw none, and helped me. And that man, Jerome Kelly, was a remarkable figure.
That's an extraordinary thing to set up
a
kind of communications or TV and radio station at that stage.
It just
stage.
Shows you how farsighted the guy was. You know, he really saw it. And equipped with that, trained at first in school, you know, at second level, I then looked for a job at a newspaper, and I was lucky enough to get one. When I say lucky enough, I'm being a bit disingenuous. My uncle was a very well-known writer in Ireland, and he was also a newspaper columnist. He was a playwright and a novelist and a newspaper columnist. And he rang up the people for whom he did the newspaper column, the editors, the owners of the Limerick Leader and Chronicle newspaper, and said, would you meet the boy and think about giving him a job? Well, they met the boy in Ballybunion in a pub over a pint. And at that stage, I was still able to hold my drink, so I didn't disgrace myself. I spoke with reasonable fluency, and they gave me a job as a cub reporter. That's how it began.
Thank you for sharing that. And I think we'll probably talk a little bit more about some childhood questions and conversations a little bit later on. But I just want to move on to the prologue to The Madness, your latest book. And in the prologue, you say that as well as writing to make sense of things, the book is for others who struggle with post-traumatic stress. I'm one of those who's lived through a diagnosis of PTSD, and I really welcome this. But how important is it for you that your story resonates with others and helps them feel less isolated?
It's hugely important because every day in my work, and you know, I've just come from Cornwall and I've been interviewing people who've been made homeless there, people who are struggling with mental health issues. And I see so many similarities when they start to talk about childhood, for example, to some of the things that I experienced. And I know that across the world, I mean, not just in Britain, not just in Ireland, but across the world, there are people who are struggling with the legacy of childhood poverty, childhood addiction, parental addiction issues, domestic violence issues. And they're now grown up. And if anything like me, you can be sitting there thinking, what on earth is wrong with me? Why do I react like this? Why do I overreact? Why can't I trust people? Why do I self-sabotage all of the time? And I hope this book can give them a bit of understanding and a bit of light. And I think the critical thing is to say to people, you're not alone. You're not alone, and there's always a way back, no matter how bloody awful things seem. They were the most valuable things that people said to me.
Yeah, it resonated immensely with me, and I think that it's so important to share these stories where we can and feel able to do so, and to help, as you say, others feel less isolated. It was the main reason we set up this podcast, to speak with other journalists about their mental health and help those who feel isolated to feel less isolated.
Much of the book is about you talking about addiction to various things, and we'll get into those shortly. But one of the addictions that you talk about is the addiction to war and repeatedly going back to it. What was it that kept taking you back, Fergal, to war?
I think there were a few things. You know, I openly say I was addicted to part of the experience. It wasn't the only thing that brought me back. I'm still massively curious intellectually. I'm curious about people and their experiences, particularly about people operating in extremis. And that, and of course my passion for history, an awful lot of the work that I do in conflict zones, or have done in conflict zones, has been about looking at how history shapes what people become, what societies become, how conflict recurs. And that comes, of course, from growing up in Ireland. But the addictive element is very strong, and what forms that? Well, I think there are a number of elements in my case, and I stress, I speak for myself here. I think there was the adrenaline rush, that sense that you could forget everything that was going wrong in your life. You know, all the mess-ups that you might leave behind in the country you came from are left behind. And you are focused totally on the job, on staying alive, on the camaraderie as well. That you get on the road. It becomes an alternative family where everybody is chasing the same thing. And you've got to bear in mind that as addictions go, workaholism or addiction to war, they're the acceptable addictions. Like if you're a heroin addict, nobody's going to say to you, well done, that was a fantastic overdose that you did there. Brilliant. Or if you're an alcoholic, nobody's going to say to you, oh my God, that was a great puke you did on the carpet the other night. But if you're a war correspondent, people will come up and say, my God, you risked your life to tell that story. It was fantastic. You're so brave. I really admire your work. You know, I love what you do. Thank you so much. And you understand why they do. And you get a great buzz from people saying that. But in a way, it kind of enables the addiction. That sense of the affirmation that you get from the public, but also through awards. You know, my cupboard has plenty of awards in it, but there's nothing there that tells you what they cost. And not just for me, I stress that, not just for me, but for the people who love me.
And I suppose also for the people with whom you work. I used to be the director of the International News Safety Institute, and I remember every few days we would hear of a colleague dying in their work, in the line of work, colleagues being injured. And as you've said in the book, you know, tragic consequences were often just a moment's bad luck away. I'm really interested in two things there. You talk about the acceptable addiction, but you also talk about the family of people who surrounded you. Tell me a little bit more about how important that tribe, if you like, that group of journalists around you is for kind of keeping you going.
Oh, terrific. I've made lifelong friends. And I think the thing about people who work in conflict zones, there's, yes, of course, there's competition, but there isn't the kind of petty competition that you can get back in the domestic scene, or that you can even get between colleagues working for the same organisation. When you're with a group of people from different organisations in a conflict zone, you look out for each other, you pass on information about where is dangerous, where is safe. Naturally, you look for your own exclusives in that, but it's... in my experience at least, the kind of bullshitters and the nasty pieces of work get found out very fast and tend to get ostracized. That's certainly been my experience. And you have conversations on the road in places like that, and an intensity of experience that you will not, you'll not ever find in other lines of work. You just won't. I mean, I'm sure soldiers find it, and people who work in the emergency services experience that. But I've never encountered anything like the camaraderie. And of course, when one of our own is killed, or takes their own life, or dies from addiction, all of the things that can happen to you, gets broken and mangled up by years on the road in war zones, then it's a very personal hurt that you feel. It's horrible going to the funerals of people who died doing what we do, because you think to yourself, well, there but for the grace of God go I, or the clutch of luck. And you think of the families, and you start to question yourself about the choices you made, in some cases still make. Yeah. It's very hard to look at a family and say it was worth it.
Talking of choices, one of the themes that keeps coming back is your experience of reporting during the genocide in Rwanda in 1994. And that's a question of choices as well. The question about leaving would live with me for many years, you write. But you decided then at that moment it was better for your mental health to not get back there physically, or to even look at stories about it, whether that was in newspapers or on social media. Can you just explain for our listeners what you were doing in Rwanda in 1994 and how it came to just play such a big role in your life?
Well, I was in South Africa when the Rwandan genocide began. I was covering the first democratic non-racial elections, the election of Mandela as president. And I was aware that something was happening in Rwanda. We saw some footage of bodies in rivers and that there were great massacres going on. But it wasn't until I arrived there, once Mandela had been elected, I was then asked to go by BBC Panorama to go and make a documentary in Rwanda. And, you know, as I recall, we weren't even talking about genocide going in. It was the kind of instruction we had was to look at this, you know, idea about chaos in the world and Rwanda as an example of it. And it's only when I got there that I thought, no, this is a thing of itself. This is genocide, the crime of crimes. And it was, you know, I'd seen violence in Northern Ireland, I'd seen it in South Africa. But this was off the scale. I'd never come across anything like it. The sheer number of dead people. I think the most difficult thing, apart from the visual shock and the smell of death, was this idea of the moral order being completely turned upside down. So we're told, thou shalt not kill, you know, most fundamental rule. When in Rwanda it became the law of the kind of the law of the street given down by the government was thou shalt kill. Kill thy neighbour. And kill as many of them as you can, and especially kill their children, so that they don't grow up to come back and get revenge on you. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people died in that way. And the atmosphere was just unspeakable. I've never came across anything like it before, and never since. And I've written many thousands of words about it. I've appeared at war crimes trials. But there's a part of it that's beyond my powers of description. That's the part of my head, you know, that I'm still working on.
You talk there about moral order and the kind of disintegration of moral order, and that we can hear from the way you're talking about just how completely incomprehensible it is, and you're still working on it. Slightly kind of moving on towards another kind of moral order disorder, kind of notion of moral injury. This is a big theme throughout your book, and I wrote a paper a few years ago with Professor Anthony Feinstein, whose work you cite in there, and we did this piece of work around how it had affected journalists covering the refugee crisis. And it's not a mental health condition, as I'm sure you well know, but it's really misunderstood, isn't it? And yet it's something that so many of our colleagues seem to struggle with, and something that affects us so much. Why do you think it's so critical for us to understand better perhaps this notion of moral injury within journalism?
I think it's hugely important. You talked about it not being a sort of recognised mental illness. I'm getting more careful about the tendency to pathologise everything, because the human mind is just so complex. The way in which people are affected, yes, there are commonalities in the way you'll find groups of people responding to trauma, of course there are, and symptoms which are broadly similar in post-traumatic stress. But the way in which we respond as humans, witnessing terrible acts over which we have no power, it strikes me that the individual response to that can often be quite different. And there are people who see these things and may well be traumatised by it in terms of PTSD, the visual, the oral responses, sensory responses, but who will not carry with them a sense of guilt after witnessing the experience, which is, I think, at the heart of moral injury for me, is this notion that there was something I failed to do, that somehow as a human being I failed when I was confronted with, in my case, a crowd of refugees, Tutsi refugees outside the prefecture in the town of Butari in June of 1994, and people whom I was pretty sure were going to be killed. I didn't make any great stand to save them, because I feared that if I did, there was a good chance I would be killed or badly injured doing it. And it didn't even occur to me really to stand there and say, you know, I'm going to sit with you until help comes. It was just, it's not like that when you're in these situations. It's just not like that, you know. There was nobody to call for help. The United Nations were far away. And you think you have ideas of what you will do, the brave stands you'll take, and then you come up against reality. Or in my case, I did. But that lived with me for a very long time. Was it reasonable and right that it should live with me? No, there was nothing I could have done. Nothing. And what was it in me that made me susceptible to the moral injury in that case? And then I think you have to be quite psychologically sophisticated in deconstructing my psyche, going back and saying, you know, this guy actually from childhood carried an over-developed sense of responsibility. And it goes back to the roots of seeing a parent disintegrating in alcoholism, feeling that somehow it's your fault and that it's your job to rescue them. And that part of me I carried into war zones again and again, and most acutely and obviously in Rwanda.
In the book, Virgo, you say you started writing it to understand yourself better. Having done this, having come out the other end, do you feel that you do? And have you reached some state of peace, if you want to call it that, by doing so?
For me, mental health is a lifelong journey, and one in which I have to take care every single day. Every day. I found writing the book absolutely exhausting and harrowing. I really did. I mean, usually I love writing. I love the thrill of getting a really good sentence. You know, I live for the day when you just write one great sentence. And it wasn't the case with this. It was exhausting. Nightmares came back. But, having said that, when I had it finished, maybe about 6 weeks to 2 months after finishing it and delivering the book, I had a sense of understanding, which I hadn't had up to then. And particularly around the patterns of behaviour, okay, that I used to justify going to war zones. So did I understand myself better at the end? Yes, of the book. But the end in terms of the mental health journey will go on till I draw my last breath, I'm sure of that.
You've mentioned a few times there some of the experiences you had in childhood and how that shaped your future decisions and work and the kind of ways in which you interacted with other human beings. And you write in the book about how childhood kind of gave you certain skills, I guess, to detect danger. It's really powerful to kind of read and see how you interweave those different elements of both your own childhood experiences and the generational trauma. How important was it for you to research into that to kind of, again, I guess, make sense of the bigger picture?
It was hugely important. And it's something we're only beginning to come to terms with now and deal with in Ireland. So basically my own family history, and many people would be able to echo this or have similar stories to tell, is that I was able to trace back to the Great Famine, my relatives. I discovered that my grandmother grew up with grandparents and a parent who had survived the Great Famine. And so she grew up in that environment of the stories that were told. And our history was mediated through ghost stories. It was an oral tradition, and people told the stories of the dead through ghost stories. And I, in turn, heard these ghost stories growing up. My grandmother herself then, heavily influenced by what she'd heard growing up, when the Irish Revolution began in 1916, then it turns into a fully-fledged guerrilla war by 1919, she joins up, Cumann na mBan, the women's wing of the IRA, and becomes involved in this war of assassination and stalking in the towns and the countryside of North Kerry where she lived. And many years later, I recall seeing my grandmother taking to the bed and being told she has bad nerves. And it's a kind of catch-all phrase, you know, in Ireland. Touch of the nerves, bad nerves. And wondering what this was about. And at the same time, hearing these ghost stories about men who'd been killed fighting in the war, or people who died in the famine. Being aware of this complex history of death, killing, betrayal, trauma that lay in the past, and sensing that it had something to do with me, but not quite able to make the link. And I think in writing the book, I made the link, because I was able to research her military papers in the Irish Army archives, and where I discovered she'd had treatment for what they called neurasthenia, which is, you know, a phrase that's very often used to describe shell shock. Now, I can't, you know, say for certain it was her experiences during the revolution, the guerrilla war, that were entirely responsible for her depression later in life. But it is significant to me, and I took it to a couple of historians as well to look, who are familiar with the archives. It is significant to me that she uses this and submits to examinations by doctors recommended by the Army, by the Ministry of Defence, in order to get a pension, a disability pension, and to get her medal to recognise what she'd done in the struggle for Irish independence. And so that whole world lay there, and as part of writing this book, I went into it in quite some detail and depth, and I'm very glad I did. And my great sadness is that my grandmother didn't live in a time like this, when mental illness was not something that was stigmatised, where there's endless, if you want it, certainly in the world we live in, and I'm careful to say that, in the Western world, there is a lot of help available if you need it.
There are descriptions in the book, Fergal, of the orphans of the Irish famine that you felt struck quite a parallel with other traumatised children in places where you worked as a journalist. Was that something that's occurred to you kind of now as you were doing the book, or did you feel it at the time when you were kind of in all these different places around the world?
Yes, at times I was conscious of the kind of parallels that existed with our own history. But I hadn't drilled down, as it were, into the specific local history, the history of my own family and famine. So I was aware of it as a kind of a national inheritance or a national legacy, but not as a local or a familial one until I started writing this book. And then when I saw the kind of things you described, these children in Kerry who are, I mean, when I read that piece of archive or that piece of writing describing these children who were convinced they were about to be consumed by a fire, even though there was no fire there. And the man describes them lying and moaning on the ground and deranged with terror in their eyes. And that could have been anywhere in the 20th century, anywhere in the 21st century, where children are brutalised by hunger or by war.
You talked a little bit there about your grandmother and how you wish she'd lived in this time where taboos were less extensive, I guess, around mental health. And you also talk throughout the book about how you've seen conversations around mental health change. Just talk to us a little bit about how they've changed in your time as a journalist in terms of some of the taboos in our industry around conversations about mental health.
Well, if you think about it, and I suspect other colleagues may say the same, when I came out of Rwanda in 1994, nobody was asking me, do you think you might have PTSD? Do you think you might be suffering as a consequence of what you've seen? Now, had I said I was, help would have been forthcoming. It's always been my experience at the BBC. You know, people were very, very quick to offer help. But it just wasn't part of the general conversation. It wasn't out there in the atmosphere, the idea that journalists as a group were just as likely to suffer PTSD as people who witness terrible things as emergency service workers or aid workers or soldiers. It's not really until the man you worked with, Anthony Feinstein, comes along and really starts a much more general conversation and interviewed a whole lot of us. And you suddenly become aware, oh, hang on, I'm not the only one. There are other people who are struggling with this. And that, I think it created a space. And then management became much more aware, much more, I suppose, acted with a greater sense of responsibility, faced up to their responsibilities to people who were traumatised, who carried home wounds that you couldn't necessarily see. And it can be difficult because a lot of the time people will manifest their trauma in sort of disruptive, dysfunctional behaviours, and whether that's the abuse of alcohol or drugs or any other of the addictions. You go from being the heroic person who was slapped on the back and told you're doing a wonderful job to being that person I spoke about earlier, the addict who's throwing up on someone's carpet or the person who's overdosing from a class A drug or prescription drugs or whatever. It can be hard for managers to be sympathetic towards that kind of individual. But what I keep saying is look for what's going on underneath, what's happening beneath with those people. Do a deeper investigation, because nothing is ever as simple as it seems on the surface.
You talk about unhealthy coping mechanisms there, and there's still a very strong drinking culture in our industry. Your book charts the grip that alcohol had on your life. What was it like when, you know, starting out in the 80s and going through the 90s in terms of drink? It was just like flowing water, you know, like a river kind of flowing past journalists in all these war zones.
It was bonkers, you know. But that was from the moment I walked into a local newspaper when I got my first job in Limerick. It was hard drinking. Now, you always turned up. The rule was you can drink what you like, but turn up in the morning and do the job. And it continued like that through the 80s and through the 90s. But it has really changed. It has really changed. I think the sheer demand, the sort of amount of work that you have to do now, the fact that we're into the age of 24-hour news, that effectively killed the piss-up culture. And I don't see anything like it. I mean, it's a different landscape. People have a beer at night and that's it, and they go to bed. And it's so much healthier. All this bollocks about, you know, golden age of journalism, people drinking themselves to death, no thanks. It's much, much better now, and much less macho, more inclusive, more diverse, wiser. I think we're in a much better place.
Do you feel there are any significant taboos that around mental health that we're still not grappling perhaps with significantly in journalism?
I think the big problem is that if you admit to having mental health issues, it's going to screw your career, because you know what it's like. You know what this business is like in terms of ambition and competition. And nobody wants to give away a sort of weakness that will suddenly, they worry a manager's going to think, can I really send them on that story if they're a bit flaky? This idea that you might be a bit flaky. And so that's very... The more honest conversations we can have, the more we have managers come out and saying, yeah, we accept that this is just as valid an injury as breaking your knee, and we will treat it, you know, with the same seriousness. It's as valid as any serious physical injury. And just as we will allow people to recover and work again when they have a physical injury, we'll do the same for people who have mental health problems. Now, here's the issue. Here's the big dilemma if you're a manager in journalism these days. You spot someone who is brilliant at what they do, but you can see that doing it is causing them immense mental distress. It's causing problems in their home life. It's perhaps pushing them into substance abuse. What do you do? What do you do? And that's the big conversation that I think needs to be had, so that we get away from a point of view of either avoiding the problem and hoping it'll go away, or getting to a place where we're taking punitive sanctions against someone because they've messed up because of their addiction. The kind of holistic conversation which looks at trauma, its effects on the individual, what the individual does to mitigate that trauma, the consequent sort of dysfunctional behaviours, and how managers then react to that. HR management journalists themselves need to be having that conversation much more openly.
If you forgive the plug here from Hannah and myself, we actually run management training sessions for newsroom leaders.
That's so vital.
To deal with it.
But we hear again and again, John, don't we, that one of the things that's holding people back from speaking about their experiences is exactly what you've just said there, Fergal. This terror that people have of, oh my God, it's going to affect my next deployment. It's going to affect my reputation. I'm not going to get sent to this thing. And particularly now when journalists are under a lot more pressure economically or organisations are, people are still really scared of speaking out.
No, they are. And that's, you know, if the book can do a little bit to push that conversation more into the open and to tell people. I mean, I've had people contact me. Of course, you know, people have contacted me and saying, I'm really afraid to say anything to my managers about this.
Yeah.
I keep saying to them, do it, because what's the most important thing? What is the most important thing? This, your mental health.
Yeah.
If you don't have that, you have nothing.
Can I take you to the near present, Fergal? And it relates to what you've just been speaking about there, covering the Ukraine war. In the book, you resolved not to go into kind of war zones, conflict zones, but you obviously wanted to cover the situation in Ukraine, and you did that for the BBC by being based in the west of the country, where the refugee crisis unfolded last year and is continuing to unfold. Just explain that situation about how you felt you were able to go back to Ukraine.
Or could we put it more bluntly, what grubby bargaining did I do with myself to justify that particular expedition?
Your words, Fergal, but yeah, please explain more.
Yeah, well, it's it. I mean, I said to you earlier that this is a work in progress, and overcoming the compulsive, addictive part of me, but also struggling with the part of me that wants to witness history. That's the thing that brought me into journalism first, is that curiosity about humanity and the great events of history, wanting to be there, seeing it, and writing about it, and telling people, because I love the business of communicating. Fighting all of that, I was in Kyiv in the run up, the days coming up to the war. I knew it was coming. I just knew it. My instinct told me. A lot of people didn't, but my news editors would back me up. Right, I said to them, "This is going to happen. Trust me." "Oh, are you sure?" You know. I said, "No, I'm absolutely sure." And it did happen. And I, knowing it was going to happen, I wrestled with myself. Do I stay? And if I stay, I'm going to be in a place where I'm going to be surrounded by bombardment and God knows what. Or do I go? And I took the decision to go home. And that was a very important decision. And when I got home, I said to them, "Look, if it does happen, I would like to cover the refugee story, because they're going to be pouring out of the west of the country into Europe." And so that is what happened. Now, should somebody like me, with my level of trauma, be surrounding himself or be surrounded, immersed in the trauma of tens of thousands of refugees? That's the question. And I'm dealing with that one at the moment. You know, the space for me to do what I used to do is getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
There's that moment when you talk about your team going back on the train as well.
Yeah.
And that you not going with them. Tell us a little bit about how did you manage that?
I was doing all the bargaining bullshit that you do, you know, saying to the bosses, "Well, you know, they've got great security on these trains, and it's blackout," you know, everything I could to persuade them to let me go. And my foreign editor, Paul Danaher, who's a very shrewd customer, he just paused and he said, "Right." He said, "I don't think this is a very good idea for you. Do you?" And there was no, "You're not going to do this." It was very cleverly done. Very cleverly. And I kind of went, and I was deflated. And I said, "Okay, yeah, you're right." And I stood on the platform watching them go. And it was like not being able to drink when I first gave up drinking.
How did you cope with that? Were you okay with that in the end?
I was. I mean, I was producer Elise, who was with me. I said, "I'll be just so much a better story if I was there to tell it," you know. And I was. She said, "It'll be just as good a story whether you're there or not."
Ooh.
But she, what she meant by that was, you know, look, you'll be able to bring stuff to it. The way you write it and the way you deliver it, it'll be fine. You know, what matters is taking the decision you took now for your own mental health. That was, you know. No, I'm grateful for people when they call me out. I am. It's kept me alive.
Going from Ukraine back to definitely more domestic affairs and talking about the funeral of Queen Elizabeth, you covered that recently as well, and that's heavily, obviously, choreographed. What was that experience like, trying to find the lyricism, the words to obviously mark the passing of this monarch who's been with us for 70 years? Was there a different sense of nervousness there?
Yeah, my adrenaline was going full belt, because you're suddenly conscious that it's you and this vast audience and the event and the terror of making a slip up, okay? And whatever else you've done in your career or your life before then will mean nothing, because this is what you'll go down for. You'll be remembered as the guy who blew it at the Queen's funeral. But I was lucky. I had a great team of people around me. Fantastic. Yeah, they just made my life easy. And it was just about holding your nerve and finding belief in myself, you know, which I haven't always found easy. I might have had something in the past that kind of postured as self-belief. It wasn't real self-belief, but I think I've got a bit now.
You've talked a lot about this journey that you're on, and certainly I think, you know, bringing my own, we all have very different perspectives and personal experiences, but I do think mental health is a kind of recovery from mental illness, and mental health struggles is a lifelong journey. Looking to the future for you, if not war zones now, how do you manage that kind of journey for your mental health, and how do you manage the journey for your journalism as well?
I mean, at the moment I'm engaged in a project going around Britain meeting people that I first filmed with 22 years ago, living in marginalised communities, and I'm really enjoying helping them to tell their stories and seeing what's changed in their lives, and that puts me in touch with people in extremis, but also in the part of me that's a historian, seeing how this country has changed. I'm up for and will be doing more historical documentaries. I'll still do new stories that have a powerful kind of human interest side to them, stories about trauma and people recovering from them. But what I notice in my journalism in more recent years is a desire to seek out people who are resilient. Because I think the great untold story, one of the problems with a lot of foreign journalism is that if you watched it and thought that that was the world, you'd run and dig a hole and hide in it forever. You know, you'd really be stricken with gloom on an eternal basis. And that's not the world. It's part of the story of the world is horror and cynicism and betrayal. But it's also, the human story is also one of resilience and courage and ingenuity. And it's those kind of stories that I'm trying to highlight. Not sugarcoating the misery. God forbid I'd ever be accused of doing that. But you know, recognising that for a tenant farmer in Wales to survive the loss of his herd 20 years ago, to build it back, to then find himself locked down because of bovine TB, and then to build back again to a situation where he now has, you know, some level of prosperity and has been able to take care of his family. That's a good story for me to do.
So how important is it? I'm hearing you talk there, and I kind of make parallels with you going back to see Anatoly and Svetlana in Ukraine, and kind of this whole idea of it's a circle, isn't it?
Yes.
Kind of the importance of going back and seeing how people are and showing that resilience.
Yes.
How important is that?
Vital.
Revisiting for you personally and also for the news?
For the news, it's hugely important. We don't do it enough. And with the result that it can seem that you're just hitting one spot of misery after another without any historical context, without any sense of an ongoing human context. So go back again and again. On a personal level, yeah, to see that people who are in much more difficult physical straits than I've ever been in you know, living in a frontline village in the case of Anatoly and Svetlana in Ukraine, as you mentioned, then being moved from that to somewhere else, then having to endure the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians, and still seeing that they're capable of smiling. And people get on with life because there's no bloody choice, you know? Well, unless you want to depart this life. The overwhelming majority of people don't. They get on with life. They find ways around the problems that are put in front of them.
We've got two questions left, and they are one that we ask of all our people that we speak to on this podcast. The first is, why does journalism matter, both to yourself, and why should it matter to people out there?
Because we have to know. We have to know. There are armies of liars and lowlifes peddling false narratives out there. They're doing that to justify murder, torture, kidnapping, the ruthless exploitation of people's natural resources, using it to justify the endless dominance of the rich and powerful over those who are impoverished and not powerful. And one of the great weapons against people like that, against structures like that, is honest journalism. A big bright spotlight shoved into their faces. That's why we do it. That's why it's important.
We've talked a lot today about your journey and how you're constantly coming to terms with things and learning things about your past and about your present and about your future. The other question we ask all of our guests is to share one tip that's helped them in their mental health journey. And we'd just be really interested to hear what yours is.
Oh, can I make it a tip and a half?
You could make it a couple of tips if you want to.
So I would say the first thing is that when you're in the depths of it, of that crucifying anxiety and despair, remember, it passes. It will pass. And I have sometimes struggled to make myself believe that. It will pass. Don't panic. This thing will pass. You're a person of worth, infinite worth. And the other thing I do is I write my gratitude list. You know, when I was kicking booze, I went into rehab and they got us to write a gratitude list every day. And so I'll sit down and I'll write the things that I have to be grateful for. And it just does me good. It takes me out of myself, out of that morbid self-obsession that can overtake me when I'm not well. So yeah, do that. But above all, remember you're a person of worth, and it will go.
Thank you very much, Fergal. It's been really fascinating and illuminating speaking with you, and we're really grateful to you for making the time. I'm sure that the book will touch many, many people as it has touched us. Just immense thanks for taking time to speak with us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, Hannah, what a podcast that was. It felt that Fergal, when he was talking, he was weighing up each word. It must have been so difficult for him to talk about these intensely personal subjects around his alcoholism, around his PTSD, but he just ended there on an uplifting note, didn't he?
Certainly speaking about one's mental health can take its toll, but let's not underestimate how important it is to do this to help others feel less isolated. Fergal finished there on the idea of a gratitude journal, and we are immensely grateful to him for sharing his experiences.
If you've liked this podcast, please remember to share it with friends, families and colleagues. You'll find us on all the usual platforms with another podcast very soon.